This is the BBC World Service, and I'm Shaima Khalil. I'm in my hometown, Alexandria, in Egypt, where over the next hour, I'll be examining the tumultuous events in my country. Events that have seen Egypt's first democratically elected president, the Islamist Mohamed Morsi, ousted from office by the military. A new interim president, Adli Mansour, has been sworn in. Mr. Morsi and many of his ministers are under arrest, and many Egyptians, myself included, are wondering, what next? In this special program, Egypt's New Challenge for the BBC, I'm going to be discussing that question with some guests here in Teatro Cafe in downtown Alexandria. But first, I have something I want to share with you. Earlier this year, I presented a documentary series here on the BBC World Service called Egypt's Challenge. I traveled across the country talking to ordinary people about how their lives had changed since the revolution of 2011. If you go to bbcworldservice.com, you can listen to all 6 programs online. The people I spoke to gave a sense of the reality of life in post-revolutionary Egypt, like my own grandmother who lives here in Alexandria, in the middle-class suburb of Ibrahimiyya. Some of my family had voted for former President Morsi in the May 2012 elections, and they held strong views about the changes that had taken place since that election.
Oh, gosh, it's exactly the same. Exactly the same.
We've just arrived in Ibrahimiyya, the older part of Alexandria. I am in the street where my grandmother's house is. There's so many memories. I'm just looking at this basket. This is my grandmother's shopping basket. Basically, it's tied to a rope, and she would lower it, and she would shout out and tell the shopkeepers what she needs, and they just put it in that basket. But also, this is where my late grandfather used to stand and keep an eye out for us, because this is exactly where I played, just right here. And that's the building. This window used to scare me in the dark.
I haven't seen you for ages, man.
You've grown tall.
Let's go speak to my grandmother. I don't want to make her cry. My grandmother, or Hagaia, as all her grandchildren call her, is the true heart of my family and one of the strongest women I know. She's in her 80s and still full of life. She keeps up to date with all the latest political events and loves her soap operas. She never went to school, and all her life, she was adamant that her children and her grandchildren get the best education. I want to get a sense from you because, you know, this is home. Right here, I feel very safe and I feel very grounded. Tell me how things have changed in Alexandria in the past 2 years.
كنا بنشبع بقى الناس يقولوا بره في الشارع اللي بره شارع لقيتي الحته اللي زي دي
شارع لقيتي كان في ضرب
سيدي جابر
معقول My grandmother is saying that just outside at the main street there were many clashes and she used to hear them
اسكندريه ما فيهاش امان ابدا
My auntie says there's no security so much conflict so much fighting
مشاكل كتير يعني الناس ماتت كتير قوي بتشوف وناس صعبه طبعا انت لو تشوفي الامهات اللي اولادها ميته
انت حاسه كويس
لا
ليه
بيني وبينك انا مش حاسه كويس
I asked my grandmother what she thinks of what's been happening in Alexandria and in Egypt and she's not happy she says I don't think what's happening is good at all I think that Since President Morsi took power, there have been problems. So many people died. She says, if you see the mothers of those young people who died, you'll feel very sorry for them.
الأخوان دلوقتي هم بيتجهوا للناس الفقراء أكتر من أي حتة تانية. يعني هم لو أنت نزلت العشوائيات هتلاقيهم إزاي بيصرفوا عليهم وإزاي بيعملوا.
But not everyone is against them. Aunt Nadia has saying that because she works in charities, she goes into the poorer areas, the slums. And she sees how the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic movements manipulate the poor, saying that the Muslim Brotherhood is trying to take revenge, to avenge themselves from society because they've never been accepted, they were always in prison. And I'm challenging that. I'm saying no, because they have many followers, thousands and thousands and thousands of followers.
So basically what she's saying is that they target the poor.
I had hope. I thought that they suffered a lot and they had so much trouble with the previous regime. They will be smarter than this because they turned everyone against them. Not
but
all.
But you voted for him. You yes, voted for
unfortunately,
him.
I did.
We always called my cousin Heba the brains of the family. And she's now a well-established businesswoman, running her own preschool and helping her husband with his pharmacy business. She had high hopes for the president.
Everyone supported him. Everyone, including all the revolutionary powers and all the youth and everyone supported him. So when he makes the right decisions, people support him, even when they are not from the Muslim Brotherhoods. I don't know why did he drift away from this path. I guess this is because he wants to empower the Muslim Brotherhoods. It's about their own benefits, not about Egypt's benefits. This is the turning point for us. You know, there is a nickname for those who voted for Morsi, the lemon squeezers, that we squeeze lemon over things that we don't like their taste. We are the lemon squeezers. I am one of them.
After seeing my family, I went back into town to Mhattat al-Raml and had a surprise encounter with two conservative Muslim women, covered from head to toe. They just got off the ladies' carriage themselves and started to talk to me straight away.
Khadija and Shadia are two seemingly young women. I know they're young because I can see their eyes and I can hear their voices, but I can't see their faces because they have their faces covered. They're wearing a niqab. And Madiha's carrying her baby, Ganna. And I can see Ganna's face, and it's a beautiful face. Where do you live in Alexandria? Are you in Iskenderun?
Ashway.
She says it's one of the slums. Basically, they're saying that life has become a lot harder. No jobs, and their income has gone down quite a bit. Shadia is saying that her husband is now, he's lost his job. And he hasn't had a job for 2 months now, and there's no income. Madiha and Shadia are saying that they voted for Mohamed Morsi in the presidential elections because he's a good Muslim and he knows Quran. They voted for Islam. Is there a big Salafi presence where you live? Would Salafi? You would Salafi? She says there's a big Salafi presence where they live and they give a lot of food staples like sugar, like oil, things that we need in our household. Madiha and Shadia are saying there isn't much police presence in their area. Many robberies and lots of thugs in their area and police are not doing anything to stop it. As I was speaking to Shadia and Madiha, another woman approached us, Nergis. She looked quite angry and was really suspicious of my producer, Daniel. She told me she thought he might be Israeli. But when I reassured her that I myself was from Alexandria, her reaction changed completely. She opened up and said that she was just fed up with the Islamists in power. She said that what they were doing had nothing to do with Islam. And as a sign of her rejection of the Muslim Brotherhood government, she's taken her veil or niqab off her face. Back then, I couldn't believe what I heard from Madiha, Shadia, and Nergis. They all voted for President Morsi, and I was shocked at the rejection of him and the Muslim Brotherhood. But it was interesting that they felt that they could speak out so freely, something which under former President Mubarak, they would never have dared to do. Back in Cairo, I met another two outspoken ladies. I bumped into an American university student called Manel as she was returning home from class, and Maisa, an Egypt Air stewardess, who told me about the battle she'd won to wear the hijab at work. First, Manel.
How are you? We're with the BBC. Can we talk to you for a second?
No, thank you.
I don't see women around here. Seeing you is like...
BBC?
I want to get a sense from you as a young woman, very, very beautiful, and you're conservative. You're wearing this lovely purple hijab. A sense of how life is different for you as a young woman 2 years on.
يعني يمكن بيطلع الحياة مش ألطف.
إزاي؟
مش عارفة بقى في حالة من الكآبة حالة من ال.
Basically, she says, look, we're so tense, we're on edge all the time especially because of what we watch in the media. There's a general sense of depression and disappointment, and that reflects on me as well. The things that we used to be able to do, going out and just having a good time, you can't do that anymore. Do you regret the revolution ever having happened?
دلوقتي
Yes, you do regret it.
قناعة 100%
100% 100% yes.
أنا كنت في الأول مع الثورة لكن دلوقتي لا أنا ضدها تماما يعني مش عارف.
You're against the revolution.
Yes.
Do you think that freedom and democracy don't really matter because now you're not safe?
أكيد ما الحرية والديمقراطية بتيجي في إيه يعني تحسين أوضاع الحياة كلها.
They say, well, what is freedom and democracy? Freedom and democracy is about making life better. It's about making traffic better, jobs better, more available. That hasn't happened. Nothing has changed. Everything has changed to the worse. Where is freedom and democracy? Was life better under Mubarak?
دلوقتي أقول لك
Yes.
بالعيوب بالفساد اللي احنا كنا شايفينه او ممكن يمكن انا مش لمسه يعني انا
Life was better under Mubarak because under Mubarak yes with all the corruption all the dysfunctionality in the society it was working and to me personally the Mubarak regime and its corruption didn't really affect me we hear a lot about you know the intelligence forces the police brutality that hasn't affected me I have not been affected directly by the corruption of the Mubarak regime. I have been affected directly by what's happening through the revolution. We'll let you go before it gets even darker. Then later.
Bye, Anel. Take care.
So, Maissa, first of all, thank you so much for receiving us in this lovely home. We were just saying the air is different here because it's in the outskirts of Cairo and we're sitting in your garden surrounded by your plants and the lovely flowers.
Tell me when you started wearing the hijab, the headscarf, at work.
Actually, starting from 1999, there was a female pilot. She was an Egyptian and her name was Nirin Salem, Captain Nirin Salem. She wanted to wear the veil and she told the company, I'm inside the cockpit. There's no difference if I'm there with my hijab on or without it. So as a result, she was fired. Then in 2001, another air hostess, Amira Mansi, started to collect signatures from the air hostesses who wanted to wear the veil on board the plane. And one of our colleagues, he was a purser, he took her to an office inside the airport. And it was Amn al-Dawla, which is
state security.
State security, yes. And they mistreated her and they threatened her. And they told her, how dare you ask for something like this if the first lady herself is not wearing the veil? They treated her as if she was like a terrorist or something. It's all because she wanted to wear her hijab. As if the veiled women are part of the ignorant class of the society, which is completely wrong. And now we're trying to change this idea. So after the revolution, we knew that the TV presenters had a case and they won their case. So when we knew about it, I started thinking, what about us? It's now or never.
So what did you do?
For me, it started 2 months after the revolution.
March 2011.
Yes. After praying, alhamdulillah, I decided one of the Fridays that were very crowded in the Tahrir Square, I took a board with me. I made like a copy of Egyptair logo and I wrote down in Arabic, give the air hostesses the right and the freedom to wear their veils.
This is clearly very emotional for you. You're tearing up.
It was very hard. And the decision to go, you were only supported by God. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. I felt that I will go and I will do this because I do believe. I do believe that this is what God wants us to do. So I noticed the cameras in the corners of the square. And I was trying to go and to put it higher in front of the camera. And 4 or 5 journalists invited me for a TV shows.
When did it actually happen that you then were able to be an Egypt Air stewardess on a plane and actually wear hijab? When did that start?
Thank God. What happened was when President Morsi was chosen as a president, his wife, the first lady, I met her in her house and she's the one who went and she served me juice to drink and she was very nice with me and she told me, what is your problem? So she fixed me an appointment with one of the responsibles in Egypt Air and on the second day I went, I met him And he told me, Maisa, starting from tomorrow, you're allowed to wear your veil. So this first day when I was going into the office with my veil on, I was like very proud, as if you're going through a wall. Actually, there's no fear, no more fear. If this doesn't come out on the surface after such a revolution, when would it come?
Is this it now? I mean, has Egypt now adopted this policy, or could they pull back?
Well, I'm pessimistic, so I guess...
Pessimistic?
Farhana. Optimistic. Optimistic, sorry. And because some decisions, you can never go back. You can never go back. Especially something related to the veil.
We're in a Nile boat called the Pharaoh. It is one of the most exclusive, most glamorous places that young people here hang out in. And the whole decor is of gold and lush. Everything around here speaks of money, lots and lots of money.
It's midnight, and my producer has dragged me along to the deck of a Nile boat in Cairo that pumps out rave music. As we get to the top of the queue to pay our $25 to get in, well, you can hear it for yourself. I'm asked to leave for wearing my headscarf.
So I take this off and then I'm allowed in?
If the promoter tells you we don't allow people in, then it's his choice. You understand? It's his private party. It's his choice.
But I don't understand these rules. What are the rules? That I'm not allowed to come in because I...
Mike, I'm really sorry.
You do understand this is very discriminatory, because of what I wear.
It's a private party, you understand?
But I was invited to that private party.
I understand.
So? I just don't understand why in my own country, I am not allowed in some places because of what I wear on my head.
That's what clubbing is, my friend. I'm really sorry to cause any inconvenience, guys.
This is unbelievable, you guys. It's so unacceptable.
Hello.
And to add to the surreal experience, I bump into one of my good friends, who's going into the party, without a hijab, of course.
I think it's ridiculous as well. I don't understand why this is happening.
I mean, it's just, I kind of looked at them in absolute horror.
It's disgusting and it's discriminatory and there's no need for this to happen in our country. It's definitely divisions of class and our,
so you think,
they have...
So you think they think I'm a different class?
They definitely think you're a different class.
So they think I don't look good enough to go in?
Apparently, yeah. You have to have flashy clothes and you have to show skin in order to be acceptable.
And this is post-revolution. This is the Egypt where everyone is fighting for their freedom. But apparently I'm not free to get into some place because of what I wear.
You're listening to the BBC World Service with me, Shaima Khalil. Earlier this year, I traveled across Egypt talking to people about the reality of life in our country in my series, Egypt's Challenge. Much of the focus of the 2011 revolution was in the big cities of Cairo and Alexandria. But I wanted to find out how things had changed elsewhere in the country. We're going to Upper Egypt, Said Masr. It's a part of Egypt I've never visited before, even though my mother comes from there. To me, it's a mysterious, unknown place. It's far from Cairo, far from the densely populated north of my country, far from the heart of the revolution. We're traveling overnight by train, about 600 kilometers south, to the town of Naga Hammadi, on the banks of the Nile. We're in an old diesel train with seats that have clearly seen better days. Egypt's railways don't have the best reputation with ill-maintained trains and frequent crashes. So, feeling a little anxious, I settle in for what I know is going to be an uncomfortable night by chatting to some of my companions. The train has set off 35 minutes late, but this is a very long journey, 9 hours to get to the south where we're going, I'm told. And Yassine, you've made that trip before. How different is it? Does it feel like it's a different world in southern Egypt?
Well, going to Upper Egypt, you're going from one Egypt to another Egypt.
Yassine Gaber is a young Egyptian journalist who knows the south well.
You slip into a different world geographically, culturally, politically, people's priorities are a bit different. You know, the sort of coffee talk, what are people talking about on a day-to-day basis? And it's not the sort of, can you believe this? You know, how dare they do this? You know, the president, who does he think he is? No, there's more sort of religious, moral talk. An example, for instance, I heard several times in the last time I went, you know, can you believe, you know, that there's a new shop that's just opened and a man is selling ladies' underwear and he's holding them up for everyone to see.
And that's the biggest issue.
And you know, yeah, and we must do something about this. We must.
So it's not the president's speech, it's not what the National Salvation Front, which is the opposition, what they're doing. That's not really the talk of the town.
No, I wouldn't say that was the talk of the town at all. No, it's very much sort of a lot of moral issues, honour. There's a lot of honour.
So it did take 9 hours to get to Naga Hammadi. Throughout the journey, we passed by many towns by the Nile, and we've also seen stretches of green fields, which you kind of don't see in Cairo. We don't see lots of green in Cairo, so that was a nice change. And the air is much fresher than Cairo. One of the first things I noticed when we arrived in Naga Hammadi was a man on a motorcycle with a Kalashnikov strapped to his back. I soon saw two more. They weren't police, just ordinary civilians. There have been many reports about the proliferation of weapons here in Upper Egypt since the revolution. Mu'taz joins our conversation.
On the 28th and 29th of January 2011 in Naga Hammadi and areas around it, thousands took to the streets. And those who protected the police stations weren't the police. Of course, they had weapons. So basically, the police here sometimes depend on powerful members of the community to protect them and to protect the town. They're the government's way of controlling Upper Egypt through powerful families.
Well, Mubarak's now gone. So 2 years on after the toppling of Mubarak and after the revolution, how are these families controlling the areas now?
Now their control is chaotic. It's all about fighting and conflict. Violence is normal here, and this has always been the case. Before, it was controlled. Now there's no control. Violence happens easily, for the smallest of reasons. There have always been a lot of weapons here. People used to buy weapons and hide them for an emergency. And now, the emergency has come.
Even in this remote part of the country, the local people followed the events of the revolution, and many supported President Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. Karam Hussein is one of the local farmers.
Of course, farmers are aware of politics and they follow it. And they are supportive of President Mohamed Morsi because he understands the farmers' needs and he knows how they are suffering. When former President Mubarak was in power, he never mentioned the farmers in his speeches. President Morsi does, and he thinks about us. He's also relieved us from many of our debts that we owed to the Development Bank. This was a weight around my neck, and now I feel free. And he raised our income. Morsi is originally a farmer. He comes from rural Egypt, so he understands us and the difficulties we face every day.
You're listening to the BBC World Service with me, Shaima Khalil. Earlier this year, I traveled across Egypt talking to people about the reality of life in our country in my series, Egypt's Challenge.
Right, so I've just walked into this small flat in central Alexandria, and it's nothing that you would expect in any Alexandrian flat, because the writing on the walls is all about the revolution. It's all about being young. One big writing here says, Kelem Kitir, lots of talk, expect the unexpected, radio tram, the underground voice of Alexandria. Now, I was born and raised in Alexandria, and I've never heard of the underground voice of Alexandria.
Actually, radio tram was inspired by the Egyptian revolution, so we can't let go now. We are with the revolution, it inspired us, and we are continuing.
Special rendezvous.
Radio tram.
Don't believe the lies.
Basically, it's because you found that you could say something. So you want... You know
what? Radio Tram is an underground internet radio station targeting 18 to 25-year-olds. They play a mix of Arabic and Western music and challenge the status quo.
And sometimes we go ourselves to the demonstrations and we live from there. We get the real idea, what's really happening in the street, we get that on air.
But when you go on air, how important is it to keep a balance? Because you are broadcasting to thousands and thousands and thousands of people. I mean, how do you keep that balance to make sure that you give both sides of a story?
One of the reasons that we made Radio Tram, that when we look at all the media that cover all the incidents that happen in Egypt, they always give a point of view that the government wants, but here we give them the truth, what actually happened there.
We did a campaign about the sexual harassment, and we give people the chance to talk about what's happening in the street.
I think what I'm getting from you is there's this need and urge to express yourselves and to say something that you don't hear anywhere else. But also, just listening to this as an outsider, I still feel that this represents something new in Alexandria, but it also represents the polarization, the division of the society right now.
The Islamist presenters, they have their own channels, and they don't work with any others.
Yeah.
But it's not our problem, it's everywhere, because, I don't know, they just get what they wanted from the revolution and they left us.
So, yeah. Division, them and us.
There is a division.
But how does that make you feel?
I feel like I don't belong.
I'm disappointed because I thought there is always something bigger than us and our beliefs.
It's the hard part of the revolution.
I find it kind of healthy because we are now talking about it.
So 2 years on from the revolution, you guys want...
to leave.
Okay.
Radio Tram, un rendezvous spécial, a special rendezvous.
Underground radio of Alexandria.
I want to stay because I actually see what we are doing here at Radio Tram, that we find hope in what we are doing. Maybe I will not have the perfect life that I'm dreaming of or find in the movies, but I'm actually dealing with it.
All of this didn't exist before, so definitely there's a change.
Yeah. Maybe.
It
should change.
It's not big enough and it's not fast enough.
Yeah.
Making a living in Egypt has become a lot harder over the past 2 years. Unemployment has gone up, job creation is almost non-existent, foreign currency reserves have fallen dramatically, and tourism, one of Egypt's main industries, has plummeted. Just getting fuel or even being able to trade safely on the streets has become a real hassle for ordinary people.
One thing you see quite a lot of on Egyptian streets are minibuses. They're a crucial means of transportation for millions of Egyptians every day. And of course, the one thing that there is no shortage of here is traffic, and you can probably hear it buzzing around me. But actually, I'm looking at three long lanes of cars, and they're not parked, they're not in a traffic jam, they're actually queuing for fuel outside a petrol station, something that many drivers have to do now. Mohammed Radwan, you're a minibus driver, and is this something that you have to do all the time, just queue for hours outside this petrol station? Mohammed says these queues, well, some people actually spend the night in these queues to get petrol. The problem with fuel has always been there in Egypt, even before the revolution. But the solar problem, and the solar is referring to the diesel fuel that many buses and trucks use in Egypt, this has happened after the revolution. Why has it become so bad? الحالة وصلت للسوق ده ازاي؟
مش معنى ان هي زادت بعد الثورة ان
محمد says, look, I'm not blaming the revolution, but I'm blaming those in power. I'm blaming the authorities. I'm blaming the lack of security. There is no security. It's absolute chaos, which means that people can smuggle petrol outside of Egypt, people can sell it in the black market, or they could just sell it for really, really high prices. And there's no authorities to come and see what these guys are doing or control them. But also, Mohammed, this solar was subsidized. The government is now trying to remove the subsidies. هو كان مدعم السولار مش كده؟
تمام. ما زال مدعم لحد زي ما هو.
Since up until now it's still subsidized, but we do hear, nothing is confirmed yet, that the subsidies are going to be removed from the solar that goes into the tourists' buses and the tourists' vehicles. But I feel a bit threatened because that means this is the first step to removing the subsidies from us as well. And I said, well, what would happen? And he said, you know what?
Solar is the soul of everything that happens in Egypt. If the subsidies are removed from solar, you won't see a revolution, you will see absolute destruction, because that means everything that has to do with everyday life in Egypt is going to be 10 times more expensive. If you look on the map of Egypt, the Nile Delta is this splash of green between Cairo and Alexandria. And yes, there is agriculture there, but also this is the industrial heartland of the country. And in Mahalla, this is what it's all about. I can see rows upon rows of looms hard at work making cotton textiles, which is what this city is famous for.
This is the Samanoud factory, one of the biggest here. Mahalla is Egypt's textile capital. Until recently, cotton textiles accounted for over a quarter of Egypt's industrial production. But there's been a massive decline, and 2 years after the revolution, many factories in Mahalla are barely functioning. Other than textiles, Mahalla's also become a byword for political activism. For years, people here have been taking to the streets, even during the Mubarak time, demanding political reform and better conditions for workers. This time, they're protesting against President Morsi and his group, the Muslim Brotherhood.
So we've just managed to get one of the workers out of the noisy factory to speak to us. اسم حضرتك ايه؟
مصطفى السيد صولا. شغال في النسيج انا بقى 27 سنة.
Mustafa says he works in this textile factory just opposite us and he's been there for 27 years. And Mustafa, we've been hearing about people demonstrating, going on strikes in Mahalla, and I've just seen on one of the walls outside the factory people saying you've got to respond to our demands. Just give me a brief idea about what the problems here are for the workers.
ايوه احنا كنا بنقبض مرتبنا يوم 27 في الشهر.
Says yes, for the longest time our wages used to come at the end of the month, even on the 27th of each month. But now we don't get paid on time, and we've got people to support. We've got school fees to pay. And so when we come here and we haven't been paid, we feel like we're suffocating. We need our money. We have families to support. And I say, well, does that then cause strikes? He says, yes, that causes strikes. This is our company, and I'm concerned about my job. This has become part of us right now. We've all been working here for a very long time. This has become my family. So Mustafa, what has this revolution brought to you? I'm worse off than before. At least before, I was paid. Things were available to me. But now, everything is in turmoil. I just want the country to be calmer. I want things to be calmer. I want a good minister to basically run things smoothly. That's what I want. But generally, things are worse off. If you want to get to the core of diet in Egypt or what the Egyptians eat, I'm looking at it right now. It's called ful or beans. And basically, this is the cheapest and most filling meal that any Egyptian can have. We're standing in front of a cart where Hani sells his ful, his beans. People are gathered around him. And we're standing in a corner just under the tree with a very basic plastic tray with our small plates of sandwiches and salad and pickles. Pickled carrots are my favorite.
Delicious.
Hani's story is one of the many I've been hearing in Egypt. And it all boils down to one thing, security, or the lack of it, to be more precise. There are no police in the streets, he says. Even though the police used to give me a hard time and take my cart off the street, I still want them back, because now I'm left to the mercy of thugs, he tells me.
That ful or bean seller is one of the millions who make a living in Egypt's unofficial economy. Some experts say they make up to 70% of the country's GDP. Professor Samer Atallah says there are actually three economies in Egypt: the official one, the unofficial one, and the military one.
And this economy is all the factories, all the businesses, all the land that is managed by the military institution. And this is totally off the books. Totally off the books. There is no any sort of civil oversight to these economic activities. So we have military operations that runs a pasta factory and a water factory. And this is, to my knowledge, there is no even basic balance sheet overview by a civilian.
You talk about three economies in Egypt, and what I hear is that
The military economy seems to be supporting the state.
Indeed, that happened during Mubarak when the food prices went up in 2008. The military came in and it uses its factory to provide bread. And if you look at major infrastructure projects in Egypt, you find roads that are built by construction companies run under the oversight of the military. And it's funny because the tolls of these highways go to the Ministry of Defense. They don't go to the Ministry of Finance. They don't go to the state. And it's a classical case of a totally independent parallel economy that is living with us. And last year, or the first year during the revolution, the military state has made a deposit of $1 billion into the central bank. And we were wondering if they can lend the Egyptian state $1 billion, how many million dollars do they have? And we don't know. We don't know.
The United States of America has traditionally been the main financial benefactor of the Egyptian military to the tune of over $1 billion a year. But in the last few days, President Barack Obama has demanded a review of U.S. law regarding aid to a military regime that has deposed a democratically elected government. Back then, when I recorded this documentary series, Egypt's Challenge, Samer Atallah gave a warning.
If we continue with this chaos, either on the economic or the political side, I expect that we're going to see maybe something of the magnitude of the revolution in the coming year or two.
Even in the calm of my family home with my cousin Heba, the reality of this political and economic upheaval is never far away.
My grandparents, do you remember this? My grandparents, every...
used to have the 5 o'clock tea.
5 o'clock tea here.
And the cookies and the cakes and everything.
And the ice cream in the summer.
It was very quiet and it was very friendly neighborhood.
But now it changed.
They changed a lot, yeah. Yeah. Now you can see the garbage everywhere. I don't know, maybe this is because of the population, because the number is more than it could stand. Yeah. This is a sign of corruption also, even before the revolution, but now this has got worse after the revolution. During the last 2 years, this is a lot worse. And even the army cannot apply the order. It might lead to civil war.
I hope not.
Since I presented the documentary series earlier this year, here on the BBC World Service, Egypt has undergone yet more turmoil and change. And worryingly, I'm hearing the phrase civil war now more than ever before. So, what next for Egypt? I'm in the Teatro Cafe in Alexandria. With me is Reem El Tayeb, Mustafa Sakhar, and Mohammed Sudan of the Muslim Brotherhood. I just want to start this discussion by asking each one of you briefly to tell me, what is your most vivid impression of last week?
The most thing I just remember, all these people were in the street asking for the same thing. That was amazing. That was really amazing.
What were they asking for?
Mercy to Tabda. That's all.
Unfortunately, I'm really very unhappy with this because democracy is being killed in Egypt. They gather together to kill democracy in Egypt. I hope that my friends are happy with this.
Well, personally, I'm not happy at all. I personally defend freedom of speech and freedom of expression to everyone. I'm personally against people being held imprisoned and captivated without any law order.
Do you think it's okay to oust a democratically elected president, Mustafa?
Well, it's not an okay or not matter if you have around 23 million of Egyptians protesting in the streets and actually signing a petition to oust a president, then it is an actual situation and the president is ousted.
But allow me to differ. This is not democratic. This is not constitutional. It's a group of people, however big that group is, saying that they don't like someone who's been elected.
Talking about the constitution, we don't really have a free constitution, and a constitution that expresses everyone, that supports everyone, that supports freedom of speech.
I think it's the matter of the constitution also. If we have the rules, if you have any comments and you want something to be happen, you don't have to be in the street. We just protest when there is a dictator in the presidency.
Wait a minute, it sounds to me like you're cherry picking your way to democracy. So you just said that you should stick to the constitution, but you actually didn't, because you took to the streets and asked for an elected president to be ousted.
Yeah, this is true, but let's go back and think about the legitimacy of this constitution and how it was prepared and how it was made. The ex-president Mohamed Morsi, he said it clear in his last speech that the constitution was made in a night, which is what we've been saying for a while now. Mohamed Morsi as well lost most of his legitimacy when he was watching the massacre happening in front of his palace at Tahdiya and people getting killed by his supporters, and he never ever said something about it.
Mr. Sudan, you heard Reem and Mustafa. Ex-President Mohamed Morsi lost legitimacy because essentially what they're saying, he's failed the people. He watched all these things happen and he didn't do anything.
Mohamed Morsi was the first elected and still the president of Egypt, because the way they stated out is not under the laws. They said that he's dictatorian. I believe first thing made by the army is to shut down 17 channels without any court verdict. A lot of people being arrested without any prosecution order. We are coming back for the Mubarak era. Maybe they would be happy with this.
Just going back to both of you, Mustafa and Reem, who's to say that the army won't do this again in the future? That whoever they're displeased with, they can just come out and oust?
Well, personally for me, I think the army wouldn't do this again because the army only did it with the support of the people. Actually, the army didn't do it. The people pushed the army to do it.
I'm sorry, Mustafa, but the many listeners that listen to you now and listen to what you just said, the people pushed the army, will accuse you of being a little bit naive, because the army, the Egyptian army, do not do anything unless they are 100% sure they want to do it.
Yeah, I'm 100% sure that they wanted to do it, but they just wanted to do it because they were around 20 million of people in the streets asking for help, asking to get rid of the Morsi's reign and to get freedom of this Muslim Brotherhood state that was developing in the country.
Reem, the army did this for protecting the people, to get the power again for the people in the streets.
Okay, which people are we talking about? Because when you say the people, you mean opponents of President Morsi. Because just behind us, there is a big rally here in Alexandria supporting President Morsi, and they say they are the people. So you're not really representative of all Egyptians, are you?
No, I'm not, but maybe I can just ask a little question. That was the same situation during the revolution of the 25th of January, and there were a lot of people who were pro-Mubarak, but they didn't do like Muslim Brothers did. They accepted what the people choose.
There's not much you agree on here, those two groups, pro and anti-Morsi, but I think most Egyptians will agree that the economy has suffered. And that's what I'd like to talk to you about now. Even on the best timetable of fresh elections, we're months away from a legitimate government. How is any of this going to help getting the economy back together, Mr. Sudan?
First of all, my colleagues here forgot that the army, when he took the power in February 11, 2011, till the handover the power to Morsi, they spent $22 billion. For nothing. And when the parliament asked them where the money spent, they dissolved the parliament.
But Mr. Sudan, with all due respect, the average Egyptian person on the street doesn't deal in billions of dollars. They deal in fuel shortages, electricity cuts, unemployment, lack of job opportunities, their incomes being slashed, their incomes being threatened. That's what they deal with, and that's what happened during the last year when Mohamed Morsi was in power.
Do you think that in a dictatorship regime, the Egyptian people will be much better in economy? Who puts 40% for Egyptian people under the poverty line? Is that Morsi or the 30 years ruling the country with the dictatorship?
This is the point. This continuous revolution, the continuous demonstrations, you may be able to say what you want on the streets, but that's as far as you go, because the country is not moving forward. The economy is not moving forward. No one trusts this country enough to invest in it.
I think it has been a real problem in the past year. The last Minister of Investment was a totally not efficient person. He didn't have the vision to support the country's finance.
But Mustafa, you're blaming one person on top of a ministry. Why aren't you blaming all the people that take to the streets and basically wreak havoc? And this is the image of Egypt now. And if you're an investor outside, you're not talking about one minister. You're seeing all these masses of crowds and you're saying, wait a minute, I'm not investing in this country. It's a risk.
Okay, I think Mohamed Morsi, when he was elected, he knew how the country was, and he knew exactly what he was going to have. And he actually gave promises that he wasn't able to keep. He didn't do anything for the people.
We speak about the economy in general terms. I want to actually get a more personal sense from you. Give me an idea about, you know, your economic background. How have things been in the last year for you, Reem?
The worst. It was the worst situation for me. We don't have any fund, we don't have any income, we don't have anything. We're just spending our money. There is no investors, even Egyptian, who can help us because they are saving money because they don't know what's going to happen this year. Everything is getting worse.
What about you, Mustafa?
Well, for me, I see it really, really sad. Everything has been very expensive, much more expensive. People can't find gasoline, people can't find water, people can't find electricity. And if the government we elected to be responsible for us can't solve this problem, then they actually had to leave.
The noise you're hearing in the background is the call to prayer. We're here in Alexandria in a cafe speaking and really reflecting on the events of last week. Just on this issue of economy, Mr. Sudan, I know you're more established and you have your own office, engineering office, but tell me economically, how has it been?
Yeah, it is not good. This is not good for everybody. Not last year, since the revolution take place. The economy is going down in all of Egypt because this is scaring the investors. The investors need stability, need security, safety, and this is not there.
I'd like to get your reaction on something. We've been getting reports of violence and shooting and reported deaths at pro-Morsi rallies. There have been shootings in Cairo, in Qena, in Upper Egypt. What's your reaction to this, Mr. Sudan?
This is what I'm telling you. A lot of people being killed. Who killed them? The police is there and the army was there.
Reem, Mustafa, shootings at pro-Morsi rallies, shooting at Morsi supporters. Is this what you were hoping for? What's your reaction to this?
Definitely not. This is not what I was hoping for at all, but I was also hoping for a better way to deal with what's going on with the country.
I'm totally with Mustafa. I'm against shooting, really, the pro-Morsi, but that was what happened for us here in Alexandria in the 28th of June. They shoot our friends, and I can show you the video. They were fighting in the street like they are in war with us.
If you wanted to be killed today, just to go over there, just to stand in the end, and you find the guns, where they're coming from.
I know where.
Yes, yesterday we got 4 girls in Alexandria being headed with the car, and they are now in the hospital, very close from here. Every day we hear about this.
Mr. Sudan, I want to pick up on a word that you said now, Reem. They're at war with us. Because in the beginning of this discussion, I said that I'm hearing this word civil war, and we have to be very careful about the way we use it. But what I'm hearing from both sides of the argument is that this is not security forces against civilians. Yes. This is civilians against civilians. This is Egyptians fighting each other. And this is a very dangerous place the country is in right now.
Yes. Yeah, it's very dangerous, and we never had guns with us in the street. We were protesting like we were protesting in the 25th of January, last revolution. Who is doing this now? It's not us.
We saw, and we have a videos. Police officers attack our headquarters here in Sidi Gaber. They burn it, they destroy it totally. They killed some of us. This is what happened. This is what we saw it.
There's been a mixed reaction from around the world to what's happening here at the moment. Islamist governments in Turkey, in Tunisia, they've condemned this. They're very worried about this. Bashar al-Assad in Syria has praised it. And Western governments, well, they're quite uncomfortable with it and have been making quite awkward noises, really, about preferring the army not to be involved, but that the will of the people must be respected. This is a question to all of you, really. Do you think the outside countries have any role in this? I mean, what would you like to hear from them? What would you like to have them do?
The United States never, U.S. never support Muslim Brotherhood. They never did. They said they are supporting democracy. Wherever is democracy bring someone, they are supporting the democracy regime. But 30 years they are supporting dictatorship. That's the way which always United States deal with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Emotions are quite charged, not just around this table, but really all over the country. And I just want to gauge from you what emotional state you're in now after this tumultuous week.
No, I'm feeling happy. I'm feeling the revolution has succeeded. That's it. I'm feeling happy. I just don't want to see more people dead. I'm against what's happening if the pro-Morsi have been treated or killed. But I'm happy that the revolution has succeeded.
I'm just disappointed in the people I once shared a dream with. I just expected them to be more humane, more caring for the country.
Mr. Sudan, for 80 years, your group has been fighting for power. In the last year, they were in power. And in the last week, they've been ousted from power. How do you feel about this?
This war is coming against the Islamists, especially the Muslim Brotherhood, since 80 years. From when the British was colonized Egypt, and then from Nasser regime, and then from Mubarak regime. Always the Muslim Brotherhood being accused by all of this, because they are looking for the freedom of Egypt, the democracy for Egypt. But all of this, they don't want the democracy for Egypt.
If last week's events are anything to go by, it's very clear that things in Egypt happen fast, and they happen quite dramatically, and it's very hard to predict them. But if you and I meet again in a year, and I actually hope we do, what do you think we'll be talking about?
Well, hopefully we'll be talking about a free constitution that actually supports and expresses everyone, that actually allows Muslim Brotherhood to have some political participation as well as all the other civilians, and to respect the law and not to dominate over the political life.
I hope that we're celebrating that we have all the things revolution wants. عيش حرية عدالة اجتماعية كرامة إنسانية.
Bread, freedom, and social justice. Mr. Sudan, in a year's time, when we talk again, what are you hoping we'll be talking about?
Next year, we hope that the bloodshed stop tomorrow, not next year. We have democracy, and I hope that we will not find Mubarak again in the street. We find an real election, and I wish that be out of prison.
Are you being threatened of arrest? Is there an arrest warrant against you, Mr. Sudan?
Maybe a few hours, you will never find me. I'm ready. I'm ready to be arrested. Not the first time. I've been in a jail many times under the era of Mubarak, many times. And now I'm ready for this. Dictatorship is coming back, and the police state started from 3 days ago.
On that thought of predictions for next year, we were just hearing in the background a huge roar, and these were Morsi supporters chanting his name, Morsi, Morsi. What are you most worried about, Reem? What are you afraid of?
People killed in the street, a civil war.
Yeah, killing people, arresting innocents, because we are now in the police state, and we suffer from this injustice for 80 years. Put the people in the jail without any court verdict. 5 martial courts against the Muslim Brotherhood in the era of Mubarak, arresting the people from the street, attacking their companies, attacking their wells, and taking their women, their kids in the jail with nothing. They did it.
A return to the police state. Happiness about the return of the revolution, as two of my guests here put it. It just shows you how polarized Egypt has become. That's all we have time for. I'd like to thank all my guests, Reem, Mustafa, and Mohammed Sudan of the Muslim Brotherhood. You've been listening to a special program here on the BBC World Service. I'm Shaima Khalil. That's The View from Alexandria. The BBC.